76 will rise again.
Oh. I should have set up the...
Oh, the stream deck?
Stream deck. It would have been fun. I didn't even think about it. All right, cool.
Do, 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 do. Do, 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 do.
Not the same when you do it, Kyle, I'm afraid.
You, David.
Shut up, Kai. Happy Independence Day, everybody. We're celebrating like true Americans here on the Human Reaction Podcast. We're going to argue about politics, slightly hungover and mostly caffeinated. Also, Congress is moving on some crypto policy. Pretty exciting. So get your bags ready. And on the 4th of July party this weekend, at the family get together, make sure you set up grandma with her own crypto wallet so she can get some of those gains.
She'll be so proud of you on Thanksgiving. Not like those past years. Welcome to Human Reaction, where we're here to dissect all the nonsense in the news and probably argue about things, because that's what we do here, apparently. Dave. What's going on?
Yeah. Well, first off, leave a comment, subscribe, do all those things. And if you do, Mel Gibson will give you this look. Happy 4th of July.
Just two patriots staring at each other.
That is a steely gaze.
For the audio-only listeners, it is literally just Mel Gibson staring into your eyes, and it says, just two patriots staring at each other.
It's him from The Patriot, which is one of his better movies.
One of my favorite movies of all time, to be honest.
It's a great movie.
Like, that's one of those ones that I put on repeat when I was younger, like when I was like 13 years old, kind of. It was like Gladiator and Patriot. I used to watch them on every trip.
Kind of Nice. Yeah, so... the BBB is on its way to Trump's desk by 4th of July. The promise has been fulfilled. And we're going to go over a couple things that happened around it that we didn't get to cover in our analysis of the bill earlier this week. We didn't get into the tea.
Yeah, the
spice, the drama of the BBB, which came out with the bromance between Trump and Elon continuing to separate. And it got caught up into its own media cycle.
Well, and we kind of speculated a bit at the time that the beef originally started that this was probably kayfabe and largely fake or overly exaggerated. But as time has gone on, that, like, because my prediction was that today we would see Elon in the Oval Office.
Yeah.
And if that's not the case, I'll admit that I was wrong. That was my original prediction, was like, we're going to see a cleaner bill form. And in some ways it's cleaner, in some ways it's not cleaner. And we were going to end up watching the bromance kind of slightly get reamended. Although we did think that Elon did have to separate himself from Trump for some, you know,
a bunch of economic reasons. Board investor pressure, bank pressure, all this kind of stuff.
It was funny because in the aftermath of all of that and all the drug allegations, the Elon's board clearly made him take a drug test and post it on Twitter.
Yeah.
Because remember, he posted that he was like clean on drugs and stuff. So that is
Can't fake those.
Yeah. A bag of peas, not just like $25.
He can't afford that.
Yeah. I don't know where he's going to get it. So who knows? But who knows? But it is also funny because Scott Bessent has been doing a lot of media tours, and there's been a lot of questions about, like, so the body checking, like, did it happen? Did it not? And there's been a lot of questions about, because that was an allegation. Well, that was the allegation, is that the black eye was that Bessent gave him the black eye.
Wow.
After an argument in the White House.
Huh.
And Bessent, I saw clips of Bessent being asked about, like, what are the differences between you and Elon? And he's like, well, Elon, like, we have our differences, obviously, but he's more of a Viking. I'm more of a ninja. Yeah. Was like the types of, so, like, there's a bit of a discrepancy on how we approach things. Like, he was very cordial about that stuff. And he's like, you can't believe everything you see in the news, that type of stuff. So it's like, did that happen? I don't know.
This episode is brought to you by Revved Up Promo, the official apparel partner of Human Reaction. Revved Up is a premier full-service shop specializing in laser engraving, screen printing, and embroidery. Not only are they now making all of our apparel right down the road from us, they can do the same for your brand and ship it to you anywhere in the world. Revved Up helps you navigate the extensive universe of merch options and uses state-of-the-art techniques to showcase your brand in its very best light. So if you want to support our show and our generous sponsor, you can now do so by buying our merch and by turning to Revved Up Promo for your own custom apparel needs. Reach them at revveduppromo.com. That's with two V's and two P's, or just check the show notes for a link.
Who knows? But, speculation. So CNN did some coverage of it with the on the beef between the two, and Donald Trump had some comments.
Defund and deport. Those are two things President Trump say may happen to his former ally, Elon Musk, after Musk, the richest person in the world, threatened to fund primary campaigns against any member of Congress who votes for Trump's so-called big, beautiful bill.
I don't know. I think we'll have to take a look. We might have to put Doge on Elon. Doge is the monster that that might have to go back and eat Elon. Wouldn't that be terrible? He gets a lot of subsidies.
Trump referring.
So.
Yeah, yeah. So he's kind of blending a couple things. That's weird.
There's two things that are being blended. Yeah, there. Yeah, yeah.
Doge can't deport.
I don't think he was suggesting that. Like, yeah. I don't think that's actually what he was suggesting. Is like, I think he was looking more so at, is like, maybe Doge should look at his financials, kind of a thing.
And right? Subsidies aren't contracts, mm-hmm. right? Doge ending a contract, a real threat. Why would they end the contract if their mission is waste, fraud, and abuse, though, is the question. Mm-hmm. So, this has the kayfabe vibes because of that. But, you know, like, and that was an interesting move from Elon, too, because he kind of initially came in with, we're going to fund primary challengers. And then he's kind of navigated closer to starting a new political party.
The America Party is kind of what he's calling it.
Yeah, a fourth party or a fifth party. We have a lot of parties in America. Just most of them are irrelevant.
Yeah, the only relevant, quote unquote relevant, third parties are the Green Party and the Libertarian Party. Yeah. Libertarian Party being the most relevant, and then the Green Party being the next one.
Mm-hmm. So this is more similar to, in kind of the political mindset that I'm giving to it, to the Reform Party, which was Ross Perot's party in the early 90s, into the 90s, that was a substantial barrier to George W. Bush's reelection. And a lot of people blame for the rise of Bill Clinton. This might feel different. I mean, Elon's a lot richer than Ross Perot, who was very wealthy for his time. Mm-hmm. But the scale difference is huge. So it's an interesting way to look at it, too. I mean, general elections are defined by, you know, the difficulties of third parties. And you can become, you know, an important decision maker with that. But can you actually get someone elected?
I did see Elon tweet something along the lines of like, what we would do strategically is just target very specific districts, which is kind of the classic, you know, what you would do if you're trying to clean up a party or something like that. Like, you would target very specifics to be able to get the policy outcomes that you want, or like make them specifically have to endorse this policy, and then I won't run against you, you know, that type of a dynamic. Kind of like what the Libertarian strategy was in the recent election. Like, they kind of did the same type of thing where it's like, we're going to not run candidates against people that are generally good and positive in our eyes, and we're going to run candidates against people that aren't.
Mm-hmm.
Where in the past, it's always been like, we're just going to run everywhere, you know, and then we're going to like spoil elections here, but the Libertarians became a little bit more strategic and more recently.
There's a faction of them that wants to be.
Yeah.
It might be more accurate. I think at least even if you have the opportunity to, if you can just get one senator and 1-3 Republicans in the House, you know, or Democrats replacing the House with an American Party candidate, you have a substantial opportunity there. I mean, like, that's what the margins are right now. Mm-hmm. They're super, super tight. What we probably will see in 2026 is Democrat momentum. The big, beautiful bill they claim is going to be what they're going to run on now.
Medicaid cuts and stuff like that.
Tax cuts for the rich.
Healthcare is being taken away.
Exactly.
Yada, yada.
So the fact that, you know, this key priority is going to be extended into them building their midterm case. I mean, that's normal. They would do that regardless of what it was. Even if they just did a clean renewal of the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act, they'd probably still do the same thing, right? Because the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act cut across the board. Therefore, it continues tax cuts for the rich.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, that's just the annoying political game that is going to go on, is like, no matter what was going to happen, they were going to spin something in some way. Like, and that's just politics. Like, everybody does that, right? It doesn't matter which side you're on. Everybody's spinning something in some way.
Right. But on the other side of that, is there a case there for the Democrats in the big, beautiful bill? you know, it's interesting, right? I mean, because a lot of red states were the ones that were specifically targeted by the Inflation Reduction Act for the green job, for the green investment stuff. If that goes away, now the people are kind of treating the green energy changes here. I hate the word green energy, but these investments from the left in those industries were targeted towards red states. If they see those go away and if that has an economic impact, that could see a real problem. That said, a lot of the dialogue about these programs were to off-ramp these rather than just cut. And there's a lot of provisions that I've noted that we didn't really cover in detail because we couldn't cover every detail with our last episode on this.
You didn't read 1,000 pages, Dave?
I read a lot, but not that much. Where it's a lot about it is avoiding people abusing the subsidies by kind of locking in current investments to maintain the subsidies over time. So if you're currently in the middle of a project or planning a project and you submitted for these things, that you can still execute on those. That was probably done in reaction to these to the structure of the Inflation Reduction Act and how structured in red states, because Republicans do not want to lose the midterm elections too badly. You know, with Trump's numbers being up, that's one thing, but will they stay up? We're a long ways from it. But
this fall really matters a lot. Because it is this thing where we've been in this like ramp up period of a policy blitz. And now that the big, beautiful bill is through, like, my understanding is a lot of focus is moving towards deregulation and things like that in the future. And that's part of the economic policy goals that are going on. So, like, I think we'll feel out where the economy goes in the fall. And that's what I've been saying for months is like, really, it comes down to where the economy is. And it's not just like the stock market. Like, it's like, you know, because like, from the numbers I'm seeing, wage growth is up. Inflation is kind of back at manageable levels. Like, it's at like 2.8 or something like that. And like, the goal is always 2, but it was much higher than that.
Measured CPI inflation.
Yeah. So like all of those numbers appear to be moving more and more in Trump's favor. And like all the concerns that had happened originally with the trade wars, like everybody was freaking out about the stock market, and the stock market's back at record highs again. So like, there was the initial, you know, dip. So like all of those things, is like, it would kind of depend on where the Americans are actually feeling in that moment. And, you know, there's time to move in that direction, and we'll see. Like, I could see Trump pulling off, just with his favorability of what I'm seeing, like I could see him pulling off strong midterms for the Republicans, but also just traditionally speaking, midterms usually do not go well for the party in power. Cause like, everybody's like, well, things still are shit. And then they move on.
Right.
Like, let's flip back over to the other side. It's like that always kind of ends up happening. So who knows where we'll see that. And another area that's interesting on Elon being more involved in politics is just the fact that he owns Twitter.
Yeah.
And like, that in itself is
X, to be clear.
Yeah, sorry to dead name it. my bad. Cancel me. like,
that's why we don't get any Twitter views, Kyle.
Elon does manipulate the Twitter algorithms, I imagine. Like, he says he doesn't or whatever, but we've seen things with Grok in the past and around with like things that were happened with South Africa. So like, he's got that at his disposal. He's got one of the most powerful information spreaders at his disposal, and he is the biggest person on that information spreader. So like, that's another area where it's like, Ross Perot didn't have that. So like, he can cause a lot of damage or help or whatever.
Yeah, Ross Perot's information strategy was buying infomercials.
Yeah.
You know, like long infomercials with graphs, like physical graphs next to him as he explained the national deficit.
Where Elon is a meme lord.
Yeah.
And that spreads way more viral.
And he's got that new media charm to him that they can appeal to people. I think there is an opportunity there. The libertarians are trying to take advantage of that opportunity by saying, hey, we already got ballot access. We can rebrand the Libertarian Party, and it could be the American Liberty Party.
That is the thing, because the libertarians do have a branding problem where it's too specifically tied to a narrow ideology. And if they're to get more political influence, I think they do need a rebranding of sorts. And something like this, if they did manage to court Elon and he just injected a ton of money in, like, that would be crazy for, like, you then have like a third party that is
the question,
probably questionably viable.
Yeah, the question to me is whether or not the infrastructure is professional and legitimate, right? And that's one of the unfortunate parts of having not a lot of money and having a broad, very broad base infrastructure that's mostly volunteer, is it takes time to cultivate that professionalism within the role and the experience within the role. And you would need to staff up functionally. And so who's there to staff up a new American Liberty Party? It can't be like Doge, right? You can't just take a bunch of engineers and throw them in, have them run politics. Mm-hmm. And the current people who know the stakeholders, who know the people on the ground, who have been making the party work for decades now, will they go along with it, or will they be?
They're mostly entrenched. Like everything that I've always seen from the libertarian parties, you have these like high school president like type of attitudes where people are kind of in this like social club, and they like to have control over their loser subject. Like,
well, they have been tempted by money before. Like a lot of the argument for
Bill Weld
yeah. was, well, bringing a lot of money, you know, Hillary Clinton's a nice person, former Raytheon person, Bill Weld, was brought into the
Fine
Libertarian
kid.
Party. But if they could tolerate Bill Weld, they should be able, if they're at all consistent, should be able to tolerate.
I think a lot of that
Elon.
Was just like Trump derangement syndrome, though. That was more so what the toleration of Bill Weld.
Yeah, but he's
be.
Fighting with Trump right now. Yeah. So like
but that Elon's like a that. Different thing. Like Bill Weld was just this like he was this nobody that nobody knew mm-hmm. who was part of the military industrial complex that was just not the boogeyman Trump, because everybody was afraid of Trump at this time. And it was like this wild card that everybody you know, was afraid of.
Well, and a former governor, a political insider from the Republican Party. Mm-hmm. Like that's who Bill Weld was. I mean,
To actually go off something that you just said before that too, was on the infrastructure, is this was a problem that Trump had originally, was because like Trump has effectively taken over the Republican Party, mm-hmm. but like he has had to build out his own infrastructure in a lot of ways. And like the Trump MAGA thing has become its own machine,
right?
That did not exist anymore. So like, or before. And so with the takeover of the Republican Party, like they've taken over old systems, but they also kind of built their own systems in mm-hmm. part of that takeover. So like people, I think, fail to see oftentimes the infrastructure work that had like the actual groundwork that has to be had. It's not just as simple as like, yeah, people can just do things, but, but it's not as like just doing things often takes a lot of strategy and time and groundwork to lay out before, you know, you actually start winning and grabbing power.
Exactly. So, we do have some other stuff that's happening kind of around this that I think is important overall dynamic to consider when it comes to the big, beautiful bill, especially when it comes to maintaining Trump's momentum. Now, the BBB is largely being sold, you know, amongst many things, right? Tax cuts and jobs are one of them, but one of them is justifying the spending in it is being done on mass deportations and how important those are. A lot of the ones we covered last time was centered around that, like new investments in Department of Homeland Security, the AG's office, and in ICE is a large part of the spending. On top of the military spending, which is now over $1 trillion once this bill passes, in the like baseline budget of the Pentagon, at the same time that's happening, I'm also noticing this interesting trend of Trump kind of signaling support for an amnesty program of sorts.
Mm-hmm. And he's been signaling that for like a month now.
Kind of boiled underneath the surface because mm-hmm. there's so much going on right around Israel, BBB, all that kind of stuff. But I think right now is a good time to look at it because, you know, he talked yesterday in July 3rd about
at the Iowa rally. Yeah.
About this. Right. So let's check it out.
And we're working on legislation right now. Susie, right? We're working on legislation right now where farmers, look, they know better. They work with them for years. You had cases where not here, but just even over the years where people have worked for a farm on a farm for 14, 15 years and they get thrown out pretty viciously. And we can't do it. We got to work with the farmers and people that have hotels and leisure properties, too. We're going to work with them and we're going to work very strong and smart. And we're going to put you in charge. We're going to make you responsible. And I think that that's going to make a lot of people happy. Now, serious radical right people who I also happen to like a lot, they may not be quite as happy, but they'll understand, won't they? Do you think so? Madam Secretary, look at you with a white hat on. Do you think they'll understand that? You're the one that brought this whole situation up. Brooke Rollins brought it up and she said, so we have a little problem. The farmers are losing a lot of people. And we figured it out and we have some great stuff being written and let the farmers be responsible. And then if the farmers don't do a good job, we'll throw them the hell out of the country. We'll let the guys, we'll let the illegals stay and we'll throw the farmer the hell out. Okay. Get ready, farmer. I'm telling you.
Got an ad from Mediaite.
Team Rhino Outdoors.
No free advertising. well, so like, that's interesting. And it's interesting that he prefaced the statement with, so, you know, a lot of people on the radical right, who I like, aren't going to be happy about this. Because that was the original truth that he put out about a month ago, I want to say, was I'm getting a lot of words from the hotel industry and the farm industry, and they're worried about the employment side of things with these policies. And so then he kind of teased out this idea, which had a lot of like MAGA really furious on Twitter, at least mm-hmm. the loud people on Twitter, mm-hmm. of being like, no, we want mass deportation across the board. Yeah. And it's actually kind of funny because I think that this is probably more in line with both of us on immigration policy, is like we're a little bit more open to opening up some pathways to non-criminals and things opening up a little bit more convenient pathways, because mm-hmm. one thing is just like deporting everybody is like, that's a monster of a job. So like focus on the criminals and then find other pathways for people that are actually like contributive. Cause not all illegal immigrants are necessarily like cartel members or something like that, you know, like,
yeah, sure.
but like there is also like the statement, and a lot of people are like the rule of law and things like that, of like, these people did cross illegally. And like, that's, you know,
and
so,
the exploitation is inherent in illegal immigration, especially, right? I mm-hmm. mean, from a worker protections point of view and a civil liberties point of view for the immigrant. Yeah. You're right. I mean, I do wonder to what degree these industries are being highlighted. Because one, Trump's personally invested his empire in
hotels
and leisure industries, right? So that will be a major like sticking point mm-hmm. That's just going to sit there. I don't know if the MAGA right will attack him from that, but I bet the left will.
Oh, yeah, 100%.
And that kind of self-servingness is gross in American politics.
It puts the left a little bit in a weird position because if they were to attack him on that.
Because he's giving them kind of what they want.
Yeah, like that is kind of a weird.
Yeah, because it's an amnesty program. Yeah. But I mean, it's a normal position, right? Excuse me, sorry. The it's the typical, oh, you only do this when it benefits you personally. Mm-hmm. Trump is a egomaniac who only wants that those sorts of narratives, who only is trying to protect his stuff while punishing regular immigrants. Because it begs the question, sponsorship program of that sort, and that's kind of what he's hand waving to, which is probably a superior way to think about economic immigration, using sponsorships to say, I am responsible for this individual, I will take, you know, care of that individual and make sure that they, you know, do the right things to make sure that they are registered and people know who's in the country. That kind of sponsorship program has long been, you know, advocated for. But it just runs into that problem of if it applies to farms and hotels, why not garment industry? Why not?
I have seen that there is a bigger list than just that. That's kind of what, like, sometimes I see this list of it just being farms and hotels, but then other times I see like restaurants and like, I think it is much broader than just this, but I think these are like the highlight focuses.
Well, they're the focuses because red states are more likely to be highly sensitive to farm labor.
True. Yeah.
And of course, he personally is invested in hotels and leisure industry. So, mm-hmm. yeah. And that's those are the attack vectors that are there, and they're real. And I think he's right. I think he's going to lose a lot of his own base support from the so-called radical right.
But there's also an element of like, where are they going to go?
Right. That's the claim.
I don't think it's
they just don't show up. That's our challenge. Or they start criticizing Trump and it demotivates.
Yeah. Right? It is. It's one of these things where I question how strong actually the hatred of this policy will end up being in reality. Mm. I think that there's like a very loud vocal minority of influencers on Twitter that are really concerned about this, but they would never actually betray Trump on like everything else that's part of the stuff. Like I do think that there's,
look at the Big Beautiful Bill and how many people have just been saying there is no deficit in the Big Beautiful Bill, right? And just like denying reality. Just to get Trump's agenda across the line. But that's one of those things, is like the deficit is always a much more abstracted populist issue, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, the real opportunity of the American Party to me is if what you want to do is run an 80-20 platform, is the still a platform that looks to major social problems and then advances, you know, classical conservative solutions to those problems radically, right? And attacking the right from the right, focused on real brass tacks problems. So, for example, deficit spending isn't bad just because big numbers bad. Deficit spending is a problem because it drives inflation, which is the number one cause of the pressure on low-income and middle-income families to struggle. Mm-hmm. If you can connect those dots and like advance that issue, then you can actually create bottom-up populist pressure on deficits, which is what, I mean, Trump was never the guy to do that, right? I mean, like, he's just not the guy who really grasps that. I mean, he thinks low interest rates are always necessarily a good thing. If you could get 0% interest rates forever, he think that would be a good thing.
That's not true.
I'm being facetious. No,
I want to, for the sake of that, because I hear people say that all the time, but like, I literally just heard Trump like 3 days ago saying that, well, we drop them now, and if inflation happens, then start jacking them back up again. Like, he understands that. Like, the problem is that we just live in the central banking system where nothing's like really responding necessarily directly to price signals. So like, we have this kind of like, you kind of have this like central control over that process. Mm-hmm. Like, that's the problem in this. Like, yeah, Trump understands, sure, that like, you can't just have zero interest interest rates forever. Like, he understands that.
He criticized the Fed for raising interest rates when he was out of office. And then he criticized the Fed immediately when he came into office for high interest rates. Now, that could be kayfabe with what you claim, that he's buddies with Jerome Powell, kind of behind the scenes. Maybe. I'm open to that. But
quasi. I don't think it's like tight.
Oh, okay. You know? All right.
Like,
yeah.
But like, I don't think it's as much animosity as it actually appears to be.
Sure. I'm totally open to that. But I'm just saying, like, it's long. I'm saying this as mm-hmm. charitable as I can. I'm not trying to be the meme, but I am kind of exaggerating a little bit just for effect. There is, as a business owner, low interest rates, especially when you're highly leveraged with existing assets, are almost always a good thing for you, right? Because you can bet in that market mm-hmm. with leverage. For regular people, low interest rates means your savings is not a good vehicle. You got to bet that stuff in the stock market, the little bit of income you have. And then low interest rates fuels the business cycle, fuels the boom bust system, fuels inflation. So and a lot of that inflation, looking at CPI, is still hidden, right? CPI is a proximal measure using a lot of things that are very soft, very easily criticizable for how people actually experience the economy versus what we measure when we measure inflation.
CPI is a bad measure of inflation in general, in my opinion.
Yeah.
Yeah. But it is also one of these things is like, because I think that there's like a bit of a mind virus that exists where it's just like, where a lot of people have kind of just taken high interest rates good, low interest rates bad. And it's not just that like interest rates should move up and down according to market needs, like dynamic. Because like right now, America is actually one of the highest interest rate countries in the world right now. Like, most countries have actually brought their interest rates back down. And I think, and as inflation has come down, I think it's very reasonable for interest rates to naturally want to come down in the coming months. I actually thought that Jay Powell would have caved and done it back in May. But the market right now is signaling and pricing in 2 interest rate cuts this year. Like, that's what the market is signaling right now.
Sure. I'm not suggesting that I know what the interest rate should be. And I agree, it should respond to market signals based upon the savings rate and how much existing reserve capital there is to justify that. The question is whether or not, and it's not about whether or not interest rates should be up or down or whether or not Trump is right about that. The question is whether or not the model for understanding why deficits and monetary policy affect the middle class and affect poor people is being connected in a populist way. And I don't think it is. And once again, my suspicion is that Trump's background kind of determines some of that. One more the note about the amnesty program I do want to know, because this is my prediction. We're going to see all those Trump history, the DC Drainos of the world and people like that, mm-hmm. Laura Loomers, they're going to say, well, amnesty programs are okay. Trump or Reagan did it back in 1986. And what's funny about that is, if you've been in politics for a while, there are 2 things that conservatives criticize Reagan for, and they won't do anything else, right? There's lots of things to criticize Reagan for: overall spending, all that kind of stuff. It's gun control in California.
And immigration.
And amnesty in 1986, yeah. Right? So they're going to all flip on that, and we're going to see them all move that way because it's all a lie. Right? There is no beliefs in this, and they're just going to go that way. That's my prediction.
What's this other thing? You wanted to talk about the estate tax?
Yeah.
What's going
on here? This is an interesting Breaking Points clip talking about the estate tax. And I do want to note, Breaking Points does have some really good stuff. I'm not trying to criticize them personally. In fact, I really like both of these panelists. And this is Will Chamberlain in the middle. You might recognize him from Twitter and TimCast.
Conservative commentator.
Yeah, yeah. On talking about the estate tax.
So let's take the explosion of the estate tax. Like, basically, you're spending something like $500 billion to $1 trillion in this bill to make it so the threshold for people who pay the estate tax is going from almost nobody, but still raising, you know, a significant amount of money, $500 billion to $1 trillion, is a lot of money that, you know, wealthy people were paying in the estate tax. It's now going to go away. Like, so, and that money is coming out of, say, extending the tax, no tax on tips and no tax on overtime, because those things expire pretty quickly. Mm-hmm. You could tighten the estate tax and say, you know what, the threshold for how much wealth you can pass down without paying tax is going to go down a little bit. We're going to say the first $2 million that you want to give to your children is tax-free. It's a huge amount of money. That's an enormous windfall for somebody to get. And then we're going to take the tax revenue from that, and we're going to permanently extend all these tax breaks for the working class, no tax on tips, overtime, et cetera. Instead, they blow out the estate tax, tons of money for Bill Gates' kids, but they make the working class part tight. Why do that?
Yeah, so what is kind of misunderstood here is the degree to which the estate tax, yes, it does apply to your stock portfolio and what you want to bequeath to your kids and that. Most of that isn't done by estate tax. In reality, most of that's done by trust fund and by placing it in a trust in which your children are participants in that trust. And that's how they get access to that money, by the wealthiest people, but even by not that wealthy people. It can be done by the middle class and does all the time. The estate tax, the biggest variable for understanding the way the estate tax shakes the economy and shapes things, especially for rural places, which I don't blame these people for not understanding this, because it's kind of an obscure Western and rural issue that I think especially progressives really don't grapple with, especially when they're urban, is the degree to which it affects assets being passed from somebody, from a parent to their children. Those assets are often are priced on the market value of those assets when you pass them down, right? Those can be very big numbers when they actually themselves don't represent much available gain, right? So if you own a business as a sole proprietor and you actually own that business and you pass it, that's all of that value is estate taxed. So one of the things that frustrates me about progressives is they're always their own worst enemy. Like they will complain endlessly about financialization and corporatization, like large corporations buying up everything and having ownership of everything, while advancing the estate tax, which is one of the number one variables for this, because you can't pass down your family farm. Mm-hmm. So you sell it to a manager agro business. So then you do avoid the estate tax, yeah. Right? It's cheaper to do that than it is the estate tax. That's the challenge. That's the problem. And then that applies not just in rural districts, but it is a major variable why we have the ending of the family farm in America, is the establishment of the estate tax. Second part of that is even if you're in a more urban place, if you have a business that's making something that has equipment and material that you have value in, not just a brand, the brand is valuable too, but the equipment and material that actually does the thing, the widget maker itself, and you want to pass that business down to your children, you have to go through some other financial mechanism other than estate tax, because if it's worth more than the estate tax, you're punished so heavily. Yes, it raised funds. Yes, I'm concerned about the deficit, but man, you progressives, you have to understand that you're advocating for a high estate tax. You are yourselves participating in the consolidation and centralization of the economy into large corporate holdings.
Yeah. Like, in a lot of ways, you actually kind of would expect, let's say you own a family farm or whatever, and because of the tax, it ends up being kind of untenable to hand it off to the children and mm-hmm. you sell it off. You're probably just like selling it off to like some big corporate entity or something. Like very likely it ends up coming in and buying up the spot, you know?
Yes.
It's kind of,
that's the most common story about why we have an aging farmer population. And we have the large agri-corps are getting even larger all the time.
This is probably the way, actually, that because you always hear about like old money, like you like people have been here for however many years and they've old money and it's been passed down. Like that is kind of the story of how your family gets wealthier and wealthier throughout generations, is being able to pass down the wealth accordingly. Mm-hmm. Like it is in a lot of ways the way for incremental growth across generations for families to kind of grow out of poverty mm-hmm. is being able to pass down accordingly.
Right. I mean, this is a classic, Milton Friedmanism, but I think it's true. People, especially when you're a parent, you understand this better than when you're not, right? You provide for your family in part so that, and especially when you get a little bit older, in part so you can pass something on to them. Right. Mm-hmm. You don't just produce for yourself. Like, and this has always been like a caricature of the libertarian individualist mindset, is that it's just, you know, homo economicus. All we care about is like the selfishness of the individual, what they produce. That's not exactly true. You look at the incentives that the person has in their life, right, that the individual has. And one of those incentives that individuals have is to produce for their children and to pass something on. When you disrupt that with higher estate taxes and higher, you know, taxes on the actual things that create value that you want to transfer to your children, when you disincentivize that, you get less of it. And so and the people who have trust funds and have these large, financial instrumentations, they're the ones who are then able to take advantage of the system that you've created in the estate tax.
Hmm. What are some of these other stuff? You have some other things highlighted that we can kind of quickly go into before we do the crypto stuff?
Yeah.
So like there were some things that we may have gotten wrong on the last episode too, or?
Yeah, let's hit that. Oh, so okay. The one correction, I said that the scholarship tax credits were taken out by the Byrd rule. That is not true. I don't know how I screwed that up exactly, but I did screw that up. My bad.
There's so much outdated information and so much changing information that's happened with all this time is like, that was probably true at one point.
I just fucked it up. Like that's just what happened. Yeah. I take full responsibility there. I just screwed it up. So just to be clear, I did get the structure of the program right when I described it. You got the SGOs, you know, scholarship granting organizations or SSOs, but this is use the G. These are nonprofits. You can send funds to them. Initially it was proposed with a $10 billion cap. House reduced it down to $5 billion, 5% annual increase if the cap got to 90%. That's pretty typical among state programs that this is emulated on. The Senate version removed the cap entirely but lowered the individual contributions to $1,700. That might be a little bit better in terms of total reach and scale nationally, but each state is granted access to at least $10 to $20 million in credits depending on the version. But that's actually a relatively good program structure. You could imagine better or broader, but as far as for limiting total amount of liability and not receiving those taxes, that's a pretty reasonable case. One of the great things about this too is this is all Blaine Amendment, and you know, like the Blaine Amendment construction criticism of it is all covered under a Supreme Court case. What was it called? Mendez? No. Something like that. It was a case out of Montana on the Blaine Amendment that ended Blaine Amendments. So what that is because it's a tax credit, it doesn't violate any of the constitutional provisions of concern that most people will prosecute this under. So this is a pretty good tactic, pretty good strategy, a relatively good program. There is an eligibility requirement, which is unfortunate, but it's a pretty broad one. 300% of the area's median gross income. So putting in like Washington, D.C. standards, which is a high income area, but 300% of that is, you know, $464,000. So this covers, you know, most K-12 students.
Like 90% of them.
Yeah. So, and then it's broadly construed, so it can go to private, religious, public school expenses, homeschooling, and other educational needs, which is interesting. Pretty well constructed. A couple of the details that we missed last time that I did want to go over is there's a red pill, there's a good white pill, good thing happened. Now we got some bounds on people's excitement a little bit. Yeah, don't get too excited about the tax on tips.
Well, yeah. So, and it actually, they kind of preface this in the video about the estate tax is why are there not bounds on the estate tax was his criticism, but there's bounds on this. So, because the taxes on tips, it offers limited deductions with caps of $25,000 on tips. And then taxes on overtimes, it's up to $12,500 on overtime. So it excludes high earners from that.
And excludes, right? So everyone has a 1250, right? And then if you make too much, you're still taxed on it.
Regardless.
Right. Yeah.
Oh,
so
interesting.
This means this will benefit, you know, people who are working in a restaurant, but it might not end up benefiting like your highly paid electricians and folks like that who are hourly, but,
this strikes me as one of those compromises that were forced to be made probably on a lot of this. So it's not perfect.
And also noting that this means it's subject to FICA and SECA. Now, at least, and it's in the program ends in 2028. Now, this is an interesting component of it too, because one of the interesting things we've seen only in the last 5 years is that tips are no longer cash, right? Tips are paid using your card. So then it's difficult to avoid tips, right? And claiming on tips. So typically tips were a direct cash payment. So it pretty much never got into the financial system for the auditors, the IRS to ever see. So that you usually didn't pay FICA or SECA. These are our employment taxes on your tip income. So now that we're seeing that, I see tax on tips as kind of a response to that trend, right? Toast brought in tipping using your credit card, not cash. So now we're responding by saying, okay, well, let's help out these folks by allowing them to deduct it. But the deduction's relatively limited. $25,000 is not small for, you know, usually people in those kind of industries, but still limited. And then noting that, it still makes a lot of sense to tip with cash because then they don't have to pay what is usually actually one of the most punishing taxes people pay if you're a day laborer or you're working per hour is FICA and SECA, right? Is it going to Medicaid, Medicare, and Social Security?
So similar to the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act, these are temporary. These aren't permanent. So these have to be voted on again in the future. Is that 2028?
2028.
So it's still when Trump's in office.
Yeah.
That's interesting.
Yeah.
Because with the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act, we went from 2017 to current year. But they made this time frame much shorter. So it's still a Trump-controlled executive branch. So we'll see where post-midterms where the Republicans are. But that's kind of interesting.
Well, and it's something that Republicans use as a shield and as a sword in the next midterm elections, right? Because they can say, you criticize me. Mm-hmm. Well, are you going to vote against tax on tips?
Yeah, Democrats are going to be put into a weird position that election for the presidency when J.D. Vance ascends to the throne.
Right. So in 2028, even just for the midterms for 26, they're going to say, hey, are you going to be what is your position on tax on tips?
Yeah.
It's subject this year, things. Right? And so then they have to say, no, I'm for tax on tips. I'm just not for
it's pretty good strategically. I didn't realize that's when the sunset was on there. So that's interesting.
My theory on these sunset provisions is they've always been a political game, right? They're always there. They could be permanent. Everyone would have voted for them permanently, but you put them in specifically for the political gamesmanship so you can rally your electoral cycle in the direction you want it to go, which is giving it saying, now the Democrats either have to sign on to our legislation or we're going to use it as a bludgeon to say you're going to not renew them.
I wonder why 8 years was the time limit on
probably for the presidential cycle. I suspect,
but it was post election though, which is interesting.
But I suspect that it was because they wanted something for the next Republican run, assuming Trump would win
2020 through 2024.
Yes, yeah, because this is 2017. Like Trump is hot at the time.
Yeah, because it's we will get this made permanent. That makes sense.
You run your presidential campaign on it.
Yeah.
Yep.
Interesting.
So there you go. And then $46 billion. We didn't really talk about the border wall spending, which is an oversight on my part. $46.5 billion for the border wall. It's important to understand that that amount of funding for the border wall is substantial. Like this is 10 times the amount of prior border wall funding authorizations. And you got to wonder what this is, right? Because the Trump administration, just by enforcing the border wall or currently has cut it way, way down. Like, they've been owning that win in a major way. What are they going to spend this money on? Is an interesting part of the dialogue.
Yeah, like, is that money needed for the... It was sort of the same thing where it was like, when I saw the 100,000 beds, I can't remember what the number was, but I was like, man, that's a lot of money. Like, but then I'm also thinking like, but there's probably a lot of facilities that need to be built. And I was like, but it was like, that. I whatever the number was, I was like, that seems so high, but maybe like I might be... unaware of what that's supposed to be, but it seemed high to me.
I feel like Bukele could build the border wall and the system.
Just bring in Bukele. Let's just contract Bukele for our own super jail.
Anyways, I do think that's a worthy dialogue that the right needs to have. Unfortunately, we're a little bit out of time, but the overall architecture of, if you're criticizing this on spending grounds and you're going way beyond what's probably needed for the border wall, given that we're in a constrained budget moment, right? That's really kind of shows the hand of the big spenders on the BBB when they're saying, oh, well, this, we're cutting everything we can and everything like that. It was like, no, actually, you probably didn't need this. It's the same thing with the defense spending increases. We probably could have cut spending in other areas and then advanced to here using an actual budget process so that you could just, you know, do more with less, the way every business does, the way every American does, and the fiscal responsibility that people ran on.
So moving on to, I've had people asking me about what's been going on the crypto side, because there's been a lot of pro-crypto legislation and an actually fair SEC environment with Paul Atkins at the SEC chair, now that Gary Gensler has left, which... You know, reminder, both at the Libertarian Convention and at the Bitcoin conference, when Trump spoke to those on the campaign, those were like the biggest applause lines was that he was going to fire Gary Gensler from the SEC. And that's important because contextually, the last 4 years for crypto has been basically all the companies leaving the USA and people getting hunted down by the SEC and their lackeys for anybody that was trying to comply. I'll get into that a little bit, but the Genius Act, which I had explained before, maybe a month or two ago, on what was going on here, it's the Guiding and Establishing National Innovation of U.S. Stablecoins Act. Got a good acronym there.
That's a pretty good one. There's no hyphens. You know, the hyphens are what really bothers me. Like, you're cheating if you're doing a hyphen.
What was
the
last time there was a hyphen?
The Biden Act. The Biden program. Yeah.
So it passed 68-30 with bipartisan support. Still awaits House approval, but it'll probably be going through. Mm-hmm. This is interesting in itself, is that it's bipartisan, because in the last election, crypto basically became a Republican policy. Mm-hmm. And we actually saw tight elections get lost because of the crypto vote in Democrat districts. So we ended up seeing, and because this fledgling industry that's been around for a decade now has actually grown in size and has large market, like, I mean, the crypto industry as a whole is like a $2 trillion market, $3 trillion market maybe. What we're seeing is entities like Coinbase, like, they have their foundations now that now are now actively involved in politics. They're putting scorecards out on politicians, educating voters on where they stand. And in reality, there's 50 million people in the United States that have crypto wallets. Mm. So, like, just as the consumers of the United States, like, in general, young people have touched crypto and have some sort of view on crypto in some related fashion. Mm-hmm. And Democrats are looking at this and they're just like, why are we losing on this issue? It doesn't feel like we should lose. So, like, they're defying the Elizabeth Warren regime of the party, who has kind of like the control over the banking committee on the Democrat side.
But Kyle was told Elizabeth Warren's a populist from the left who cares about poor people.
Well, that's the thing, is Elizabeth Warren has always been the banker candidate. Like, it is funny. Like, I've said this on the podcast so many times before, but when she was running as the female Bernie Sanders in the election, and she's like, I'm just Bernie, but not sexist. That was her thing. Right. And then when everybody got the nod, time to drop out, Biden's the candidate on Super Tuesday, and the only person to stay in was Elizabeth Warren so she could steal votes away from Bernie, is like, she's always been the banker candidate. Like, that in itself is kind of
the deep game right there.
And she's like the head person that runs the CFPB, the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, bureau or whatever it's called, that is the attack dog. Like, she's the one that put out on her Twitter, is like, it's time for the war on crypto. And she's like, Elizabeth Warren's crypto, like, anti-crypto army. And like, crazy thing about
it. How much of that is crypto's association with men versus crypto? You know what I mean? Is it really just a war on men? It's just crypto is the proxy.
War on crypto bros.
Yeah, right.
Well, so here's some important context. And I actually want to...
It's actually a feminism thing.
It's actually a feminism thing. Pocahontas has not too much. So I want to pull from the All In podcast. David Sachs, who is a member of the All In podcast, but he's also the AI and crypto czar. He was talking about the Genius Act's approval. And some of this is him kind of providing context to what was going on in the industry. And I think this will help enlighten people of like where the industry has been and how far it's come in the last few months.
When you consider where we were a year ago, you know, you realize what huge progress this is for the crypto industry. A year ago, you had crypto companies being prosecuted. You had this whole regulation through prosecution approach, where Gary Gensler, who was the chair of the SEC then, he wouldn't tell startups what the rules were, but they would just announce prosecutions. And this was driving all the crypto innovation offshore. And I think we were basically poised to lose the crypto industry in the United States. What happened then is President Trump adopted this cause. He announced that he wanted to make the United States the crypto capital of the planet. He really campaigned on this. And as part of his administration, he, in the very first week, signed a new executive order making it clear that his administration supported crypto. We've been rooting out all the Biden war on crypto rules and regulations at the agency level. And now we have this first major legislative win. And I would expect the House will act in the next few weeks on this, and then the president will have a bill he can sign.
Yeah, so in the backdrop of all of this, kind of what David Sachs is illuminating is that there was this thing called Operation Choke Point 2.0. The original Operation Choke Point was largely aimed at by the Obama administration to target the banking of weed distributors and gun manufacturers. Mm. Like, it was to like literally choke them out, Operation Choke Point. Mm-hmm. And then this model kind of became not used in name, like they never used it by name, but it's became the popular term for it, mm-hmm. is Operation Choke Point 2.0, where it was squeezing out the finances of anyone involved in the crypto industry. Like if you're a startup, if you're trying to do some sort of like bank competitor, if you're trying to start up an exchange or whatever. Mm-hmm. And it got so bad that at the point where the SEC is like, crypto industry, we don't have to be enemies. Come in, talk to us. Come in, bring your guys, we'll talk to you. And then when in the meetings with Gary Gensler, if he took the meetings, they'd have like the SEC enforcers there writing down everything that they're doing at the industry. And there's like, well, this is the stuff that we're doing. And like, yeah. This is the stuff that we need help on. This is the stuff that we need clarity. Then they'd go back 24 hours later, Wells notice.
Yeah. What's a Wells notice?
Just like a warning that we got the Eye of Sauron is upon you, yeah. And we are going to be pursuing legal action against you for violating laws that there's no clarity on.
Yeah, yeah. Right? Which has a tremendous economic effect, right? Yep. It pretty much says if you're going to invest in this company, it's gone from one rate of risk to a exponentially higher rate of risk, right? Because now you have the government. They might be out of compliance.
Yeah, and right now, so we have Paul Atkins is a great SEC chair right now. We have Bessent and Lutnick at the Treasury and the Secretary of Commerce have also been very great on crypto. Pudgy Penguins is an official White House crypto advisor, which nice. like the company, which is weird, but that's company I invest in, so I'm happy.
Yeah, there you go.
So you end up having this, like, everything's like super become very pro crypto, and it's also becoming bipartisan in a strong degree. Mm. So what's actually in the bill is there's a lot of people that have opinions about the bill that's just like this, the bill doesn't tackle that.
Dude, I heard it's going to implement a Fed coin.
Yeah, like CBDC kind
of
thing, right?
Yeah, yeah, that's what it's all about, actually. That's the real reason for it.
I think that is a future battle. I don't think that is this battle. and that's where everybody's kind of like framing things up like that's the battle we're fighting right now. Is like, no, all that this battle is right now is that it's trying to encourage stable coins to become and the companies to be brought into the US. Like very much what we're probably going to end up seeing is Tether going public in the US. Like, they're probably going to move all their operations to the US in the future and going public.
Okay.
And it requires stablecoin issuers to go under audits and make sure that we know things are backed one-to-one with either actual cash or like liquid cash equivalent items like bonds.
Okay. Is it a private audit or a government audit?
Government audit.
Okay.
Yeah. Because right now there's like kind of these like weird third party audits and things like that. So yeah. Like, and I believe my understanding is that falls under the regime of the Treasury. Like the Treasury is the one that's supposed to be looking at that. Mm. So that falls under like Bessent and those types and whoever the future Treasury secretaries are. It does create, there is some concern here where it does create some regulatory capture. There's some licensing that's involved in this, but it also provides things like insurance for if a stablecoin went defunct in the future, mm-hmm. because that has happened in the past. Mm-hmm. Like stablecoins have lost their pegs and collapsed in the past. Mm. Circle and Tether, the top ones, have never had those issues. But yeah. It offers consumer protections and it actually favors the consumers over the creditors. So which is just like you're more safe
As a consumer,
yeah. if you're holding these things. Mm. Puts very strict rules on the reusing of those assets that are backing the coins. Because that's kind of like what happened at FTX, where they were reusing the assets that were customer funds.
Right.
And then FTX collapsed.
Yeah.
I want to play, because a lot of this, actually, from the game theory perspective, I actually think a lot of this has more so to do with the bond markets. We've talked about the bond markets and the stuff on the past with a lot of like the trade war stuff. Mm-hmm. Scott Bessent has been doing a bunch of interviews and he's been talking about it at the Treasury. And he very specifically, I don't think he says in this clip, but he's been saying that he believes that, or like the reports are showing that there's probably about $2 trillion in demands for US bonds once this gets passed, because this is a massive market. I don't think people realize how big the stablecoin market is. It's like Tether makes more money than BlackRock does.
Yeah. Before you do though, in case that this is just suggesting it, how does stablecoins increase bond demand?
Because what this bill is requiring is that you need one-to-one liquid assets that are like dollar equivalents.
So you think they'll buy bonds in order to back their...
They already do. Okay. But now it's like this is like a requirement of like either having direct cash or bonds or you know, something that is like tied to the dollar in some way,
right?
That can be easily bought and sold and is highly liquid.
Got it.
If you're a stablecoin provider, like how do they make money? They're making money off of the interest on those bond rates. Mm-hmm. They're making money off of the assets that they're holding in order to be able to back up the dollar so that everybody has this like ecosystem of these coins. Mm-hmm. Right. Here is Scott Bessent talking about it in an interview with the New York Post.
There's a new book called King Dollar, a journalist who's followed Treasury for about 40 years.
Yeah.
And he talks about every time there was a narrative that the U.S. was going to lose reserve currency status, why it's never happened.
Mm-hmm.
And
because crypto, that seems to be a threat to the dollar, doesn't it?
I think it's the opposite.
Oh, really?
I think stable coins could reinforce dollar supremacy, because with stable coins could end up being one of the largest buyers of U.S. treasuries or T-bills.
Mm-hmm.
So all of a sudden, if you are using a stable coin in Nigeria that's backed by the U.S. dollar, you don't actually have to have dollars. It's on your phone. You can transact. So I think there's a very good chance that crypto is actually one of the things that locks in dollar supremacy.
And is that why it was crucial that Donald Trump get involved in crypto rather than trying to constrain it like Joe Biden was?
I think constrain's too mild a word. I think make it extinct.
Oh.
So this administration's commitment to digital assets, it's innovation, because there's so many other things that happen around digital assets. And also, it's one of those things that it's one of the most important phenomena that's happening in the world, and the U.S. just ignored it.
Yeah, so I can see where he's going with that. He's saying like, yeah, maybe Bitcoin competes with the dollar in some way, you know, or was meant to.
It's really to more competitive with gold at this current standpoint.
With, yeah. Thanks to the small blockers or whatever. I'm just joking. I'm also serious. So the stable coins are a backer of U.S. Treasury bonds, therefore dealing in dollars. And important that he didn't know, but I do think it's worth saying, with much lower fees than the traditional ways of putting that on the rails of the financial system. So there's, you know, consumer gain in that from a market perspective. That's why stablecoins have demand, right? It's because you can move money around without the need of Westinghouse or whatever they are. Not Westinghouse. That's not they're a what light are they? Bulb maker.
No.
You know what I'm talking about, though.
Yeah, Western
Union.
Western Union.
Yeah. Yes, that's it.
Yeah. Yeah, which that has been kind of like that was the El Salvadorian take on a lot of the crypto adoption was actually a way for to get around the remittance fees around like Western Union getting back because there's like all these middlemen that go on. So if you're trying to like crypto is really useful if you're trading internationally.
Yeah,
it's extremely useful if you're trading internationally.
So will the new remittance fees that are built into the BBB apply to crypto?
I imagine, like, because you're probably going to be because what the natural thing that's going to happen, and this is where like the libertarian side of crypto is that there's going to be probably a lot more stricter AML, anti-money laundering law, KYC, your customer, which is like the thing where when you go to a financial institution, like if you're signing up for Coinbase, like this already exists on all of the things, like anywhere that you're buying crypto, like from a centralized place, you're already giving your social security number, like you would a bank, like. That's just kind of, you know, the unfortunate thing from a libertarian perspective.
That approach has been far more successful. Now, what I would like to have seen is if the Genius Act had some kind of regulatory sandbox or something like that so that you could still have those spaces for innovation so you don't get a lot of centralization, which is where this will probably lead to is a lot more, you know, a couple big cryptocurrency companies who are licensed, who are running stable coins. But if you got an innovative new idea, that might not fit in, especially with different administrations. So a regulatory sandbox could be one of the things that would prevent for future administrations from doing what the Biden administration did.
And that's what my understanding is. That's what a lot of the there's some real champions on the crypto side in both the House and the Senate. Tom Emmer, the House Majority Whip, is a big guy on the crypto side. Cynthia Loomis out of Wyoming in the Senate has been like the champion for the Republicans. As well as Kirsten Gillibrand on the Democrat side. She's been exceptionally good for the Democrats on this issue. And that's a lot of the framework that's being talked about. And if you listen to like just their speeches at the Bitcoin conference, for instance, like they talk about the sandboxing and wanting to implement those things.
I imagine that's step two for the crypto industry too. Like you're literally getting put into the white market now.
Yes, exactly.
And so your next step is, okay, we're in the white market now. If Democrats want to get some of our votes, Republicans, if you want to keep our vote, you need to start advancing regulatory sandboxing and things that allow us to innovate in our market space and continue innovation in market space.
And that's also a thing too with Paul Atkins at the SEC. He's been very good on clarifying, and the SEC, just like their Twitter page, has been really good on clarifying of like this is and this isn't a violation of securities law. Like actually laying out the framework of what they think is like in their purview, which is not in their purview, what needs legislation, all that stuff. Mm-hmm. And it's making it a lot more on the decentralized finance side, which is like DeFi is like people can just like make protocols and those protocols operate on their own. And so it's like, it becomes like, well, if the protocol does something bad, do you like imprison the, the creator? And it's like, you know, it becomes this thing.
And so the Genius Act doesn't really affect DeFi.
It's just this is where I've gotten into so many arguments with crypto people where just like the Genius Act lays it out for them to like it's a war on DeFi. It's like the Genius Act has nothing to do with DeFi. Right. It doesn't even mention DeFi.
But I can see that because stuff. It doesn't touch it. A typical market phenomenon response to government new rules is to deinvest from things that weren't governed and put it into stuff because the risk is lower there, right? Because you're not going to get the government going after you. So are they going to do anything on DeFi?
Well, Paul Atkins, very specifically at the SEC, has been very public on wanting the innovation of DeFi to happen in the United States and allowing for that whole world to occur. Mm. So that in itself is just positive. And I know Cynthia Loomis is big on this stuff too. So like, there's going to be more frameworks that are continually pushed on this. Yeah. Like we're still, like you said, we're now like, it's okay to do this thing. Like the industry is not going to go extinct. Like we should just be happy that the industry is not going extinct.
You especially.
There are some things because like, one of the things that didn't make it into the bill and they really tried to get it into the bill, but unfortunately the banker lobbyists are the ones that push back against this because the bankers, they're slowly creeping into the industry, but right. like it is competition for them. So they need to adapt. Like, uh-huh. like I think I saw Visa is beginning to work on their own stablecoin, like for instance, which in itself is also interesting. There was a want for interest bearing accounts for like, stablecoin providers to be able to share some of the interest that they make with the users based off of like how much of the ownership that they have of the coin.
Yeah.
But that is still illegal according to this bill.
Huh.
But just because it hasn't been addressed on this bill. But the reason why it wasn't addressed is because
the bankers
yeah. they don't want you making interest outside of their accounts. And this has been one of the things with the exchanges and the SEC was because the exchanges started to create ways of giving interest to their customers based off of their crypto holdings and like staking it with them and stuff like that.
Right.
And the SEC is like, no, that's a bank's rule. A bank does that. Mm-hmm. So like, you can't do that as a crypto exchange. So right. like, it's still this kind of
financial institution rather than just a, yeah.
Yep.
It is interesting to me, the hypocrisy in that space from banks, right? Both on the interest bearing that, but also in requiring one-to-one when we don't require banks to do one-to-one.
Isn't that interesting?
Right? So fractional reserve banking is one of the phenomena, the downstream phenomena of interest rates and bank loaning processes where the money supply grows by leverage and by, you know, people taking out loans as a secondary or a consequence. Now, there's long been a libertarian critique of that says like, hey, when I put my money in the savings account, I actually just want you to hold it for me. I don't want you to loan it away to somebody else who's not there.
People don't realize what banks actually are. Is that they're loaning out your money and things like that. Yeah.
So, but then they require that of the new competition. Like, you have to be one-to-one, but we don't have to be. Because even your checking account money is just on the ledger that they can then use as their assets when they claim for their leverage when they want to go play in the stock market. Well, that's why these things exist. That's why banks go bankrupt, guys.
Well, and that's the thing about crypto is because of blockchain, you know exactly where all the money is.
Yeah.
Like that's kind of the nice thing about it is it's a public ledger. Like you can see, like it's pseudonymous, but like you can see this wallet has this much money. This wallet has this much money. You don't necessarily know who that each person is that owns those wallets, but you can see it there. So you can look at like what will become standard practice. And this has become more of a standard practice in the crypto industry as a whole, especially after the FTX collapse, is that it's become very standard for exchange. Like it's pretty much like you shouldn't put your money on an exchange that's not publicly showing their reserves. Mm. Like that has become the standard practice for all exchanges.
Are you telling me that market failures produce better institutions?
Yeah. Yeah, I am telling
Holy
you that.
Cow. Who saw that coming?
There's one more thing. This is actually a different bill that's coming in, but it's currently being introduced by Senator Lummis. But this is where like the time is now for crypto adoption. Like it's been this nascent industry since 2008. It's been a while. It's taken a while to kind of get here, and it's had its roadblocks. But Senator Lummis has an interesting bill that provides a de minimis exemption for crypto transactions. Mm. What that means is transactions under $300 are non-taxable.
Like in a single transaction.
Yeah. Up to annually $5,000. So you can
Not
have...
Bad.
So. She wants to get it higher, but this is the compromise.
That's
position,
a great
right?
start. I it's think for your start. Average crypto user, that's a pretty goddamn good start.
And it gives more incentive for your coffee shop to accept crypto payments and so on, especially we're talking about stable coins.
And it provides competition to the centralized money movers like Venmo and things like that, where, you know, one of the reasons why people won't take my crypto is because they then have a taxable liability on it, right? They're like, I don't want to deal with that.
Yeah.
When they could just accept it by Venmo and there's no taxable liability. So this would provide much fairer competition between those different kind of technologies.
Another area is that there's been double taxation on crypto. If you are a staker or a miner, or there's some sort of like crypto awards that you're receiving, anything that's like crypto rewards awards related, it's a taxable event upon the time of receiving it, which is kind of like crazy because if somebody else gives you an award, like that can be a tax bomb on you.
Wow.
Like that's, which is kind of like a dangerous tool,
right?
That existed. Those taxes are now going to be deferred, so there's no longer double taxation.
If this bill gets through. You said are now. It's
yeah,
so,
sorry. Yeah, sorry. Yeah.
I don't want anyone to thinking like this is happening.
It appears to me that this bill is going to be going through, but like, yeah.
Cool.
Yeah. Just wait on that. So, but it's at the time of selling is when the taxable.
Okay.
So like if you mine the coin, the taxable event is if you're a crypto miner, like if you mine Bitcoin, it'll be selling the Bitcoin before you got taxed at the point of getting the Bitcoin mining reward, and then when you sold the Bitcoin.
Why didn't they change that by rule, though? That seems like a rule decision change of when the taxable event happens.
I'm not sure the specifics on how the policy is going down, okay. But it's part of the bill,
think it would rule that immediately and then change it by legislation. But I get it. It's complicated. That's that's why I never take anything off stake.
You just leave it there. You don't want to just keep doing the thing.
Don't want to get more liability.
So now if you've been waiting patiently like a good little boy, you're probably going to be able to defer that. And then there's just like general cleanup of rules around like charitable giving and like there's like all these different rules. They've closed some loopholes on tax loss harvesting, which I think will bum out a lot of people. Like before you could play games of like calculating your losses and then to avoid taxes and stuff like that. But
I saw something about that on a podcast about like selling your Bitcoin at a loss at the end of the year and then buying it back at the beginning of the year.
In order to like bring taxes down and stuff like that. People do that all the time. There's AI applications that help you with that for your taxes and things like that. Yeah. but like overall, like in general, the like crypto, it is like I said this in a previous episode, in JD Vance's speech to the Bitcoin conference this year, like the Republicans in general that spoke at the Bitcoin conference, they made it very clear that in their minds, the three most important industries of the future are AI, crypto, and then energy, because it's required for those two.
Right.
Like that is, and you kind of like Bessent said it in the clip too, is like, this is an incredibly important industry and the Biden administration was basically trying to make it extinct. And now it's like, nope, this is the American industry now.
Yeah.
And they're trying to create all these incentives for American made crypto companies and all this stuff. So going forward, it's like, I would not be surprised if come this time next year, the landscape and what we see with crypto transactions, like just in your day-to-day life, we're probably going to begin seeing that.
That's very encouraging, especially if they can get around to the stuff that is competitive to the dollar so that people have a hedge against inflation that isn't punished so much with taxation.
Well, and that's also the other thing is like, we do have there is a Bitcoin strategic reserve that the United States has right now, right?
Right. Do they get taxed if they sell it?
Does the government get taxed? I don't think so. I don't think that's how that works, David.
It's only when you sell it.
Most of that crypto is
stolen
crypto that they took from people. Like that's like Silk Road crypto.
Right.
Speaking of, Ross Ulbricht is free, and he gave a very powerful speech at the Bitcoin conference.
Did he? Yeah. Oh wow, I got to check it out.
He had like a 30-minute speech.
Well, and we're seeing an alignment that is very common when the Democrats really screw up, right? Mm-hmm. The Democrats really screwed up when they tossed out tech and tossed out AI and tossed out crypto. I mean, the broader tech movement moving to the right is a tremendous development that the right wing is trying to contend with, right? You got the MAGA people versus the tech bros.
Fighting against it.
Yeah, the populists versus the, what do they call them? The bro, it's like a bro and a plutocrat in one word. Brotocrat, something like that.
Plutobros? Yeah. I'm not sure I know that one.
Yeah, that was a Steve Bannonism. But this whole dynamic is the power of the Republican Party at the moment, to the degree that you're bringing in people who have money, a large interest group, and folks that are aligned to your cause. And the question is, can they maintain that without it breaking apart due to the conflicts that are happening within the party? And then outside that, if Democrats can actually cultivate the crypto vote by moving along, like Senator Loomis.
Yeah, no, because like she is like known as the crypto senator, which is just kind of interesting. And Wyoming is like the biggest safe haven for crypto in all of America. They're the most pro crypto state. Like they have a cryptographic school at the university there, like a cryptocurrency school, like entirely based around cryptography
and
Rust programming and stuff like that. They are the best when it comes to state legislation on. And it's actually also, you have all these states now introducing bills for their own Bitcoin reserves too.
Oh, really?
Like I think Texas just signed into law a Bitcoin strategic reserve. There's a few other states that have now too. So I mean, it's where the world's heading, and like this is going to be like, it's going to be as significant as a transformation as moving to credit cards. And I think that it's going to be a generational thing. Like you shouldn't expect your grandma to get into crypto. But
don't take my advice at the top of the podcast.
Yeah. But if you're anybody that's kind of tech savvy, you grew up in the internet age, like I think it's going to be pretty normal to see crypto adoption across the board, like in the same way that, I mean, Like a lot of kids just use like Venmo now instead of credit cards or whatever. Right. Like it's the same type of thing. Like we're just watching that transition happen in real time.
Mm. And the government had to act on it eventually. And this is the opportunity for hopefully a shaping of something that doesn't consolidate the marketplace into a couple major players. And you know, my interest as we're looking at this is you got to, yeah, a way to orientate to think about this. Celebrate the wins as they come along, but insist on the long-term vision of maintaining what made the crypto market great, which is the space to innovate, the space to try new things with and you know, back before the Biden administration was cracking down on everything, so that you can get the actual competition with the dollar, competition with the financial institutions based upon new technologies.
Yeah, and this actually maybe one final thing, something that I forgot to mention on this bill is that, and this is where like you maybe could have concerns for regulatory capture, is one thing, because there are things like there are decentralized stablecoins, and this bill specifically prohibits, I think for like 2 years, American-made decentralized stablecoins for the Fed and the Treasury to study the thing. But it is this problem.
Okay, where, so that's the sense in which it's anti.
Yeah, but like that's not DeFi per se. Yeah. Like it's kind of a different, like it's like DeFi adjacent. But it is one of these things where we have in the past seen like Terra Luna collapsed, and that was a decentralized stablecoin. Mm-hmm. You know, there's evidence to suggest that maybe it was assassinated in the peg breaking, but it collapsed during the FTX phenomenon. So there was a big contagion that was spread. And in the past is like you have Nikolai from MakerDAO, who was killed or was found dead off of the shores of San Juan. And there's some black market games that go on in that space. Mm. So it is kind of interesting is like, I'm curious what ends up happening with that in the future, because there is a 2-year prohibition on that for the time being. So
interesting.
Yeah.
All right. Well, wins and losses, how it goes. That's politics for you, baby. So thanks you so much for watching Human Reaction. Have a great 4th of July. We got a skiff coming up. We're going to be giving our look back, our look forward on Iran. Am I a panican? Is Kyle a Trustakinian?
I'm telling you, leave the branding decisions to Trump.
We'll guys catch you in the skiff. If you want to become a member to see all that great stuff and get our whole backlog of all of our members exclusive analysis, the skiff is usually a little less newsy, a little bit more large, kind of step back and look at the big phenomena type episodes. If you want to become a member, go to humanreactionpod.com, where you can sign up on YouTube or on Substack to get those episodes. Thank you so much for watching. We'll catch you guys next time.
Peace.
Thanks for tuning in to Human Reaction. Please be sure to like, follow, subscribe, and give us a review on your podcast platform of choice. And if you want to become a member and support the show financially, check out humanreactionpod.com.